Next, did you have your hand up? Yeah, okay. In the back.
And I illustrate these stories as well, and I would really like to get off disability so I can choose where I want to live and choose which doctor I have, choose which counselor I have, and choose where I live, you know, and choose what I do for a living and choose what clothes I buy. And I tried to get into university on a bursary. I was given the royal runaround, and that was 4 years ago before I was in a wheelchair, and I got so discouraged I just gave up. And I was finally told, I tried for 2 weeks to get registered. I went to the English department, I talked to somebody over there. I was shoved over to another part of the campus. They said, why are you over here? I said, well, because they sent me over here. And it was so discouraging. And it's like, I didn't speak the language and they didn't understand what I was saying. So I was given the wrong runaround and it was really discouraging. So I still want to do this, but, you know, now I'm in a wheelchair. But I still write children's stories and I still illustrate. But I don't have the money to become, self-publisher. I would like to self-publish my children's stories. But I don't have connections to a publisher or the money or the means to do this. So this is another attack on me as a disabled poor woman. So it's like, as far as free education, hell, I'd have to get one, you know? So anyway, that's just what I wanted to say. And I just lived like 20 minutes away from the university where I wanted to go. And I said, well, if it takes me 5 years, that's fine. But they said, if I do get accepted, I would have to take my chance that maybe there's room in the classroom before all the other students get there, like the younger ones. But because I'm disabled, I take a chance that there's still a space. That's what I was told by the university. So, and that was 4 years ago. And there is a plan for the government to put all disabled people back in institutions. Okay?
Yeah. The woman right there. Yeah. Just if you just put your hand up, I'll keep track of the speakers and stuff.
I'm just curious to know if the plan for economic disruption will include labor disruption. How will we manage disruption of work for service workers, for example, who might be targets of a labor disruption, economic disruption campaign, who may be depending on very meager wages just to get by from month to month. And while I can see the long-term benefits of an economic disruption strategy, in the short term I'm quite concerned about people who might be deprived of income for a day or two and what sort of consequences that will hold, especially for women and other vulnerable groups who are really, really who have no safety net, as we know.
The woman, the white shirt.
Okay, my name is Sister Helen, and I have lived most of my life in South America. For the young people in here, I know that it's very hard to understand, because when I was young, my father had to pay for my education. My father had to pay. We didn't have a way, and we fought for that. I come back to this country and I don't understand what happened to it. I never saw before food banks. I never saw so many homeless people, and I don't understand my country. I have lived with resistance people, indigenous people. But what I find in Canada very wrong, which I think we have to fight right now, is individualism. I have seen community, I have participated in resistance with the people, and people were being killed in Peru and Bolivia. And I've been to Salvador, Nicaragua. So I think there's something really wrong with all of us, which we have to build first. And it's got to be community building. Because she may be suffering, and you may be suffering, John, because I know you a long time ago. I remember you from Development Peace. I think there's something wrong with us in this country. And that's why anything we do, like when I went to Quebec City, we were community building, popular education. The real revolution will not be with guns. I've seen people being killed. There's something done when Monsignor Romero said, they will kill me, but I will resurrect my people. I work with Salvadorians. I know what it means to be a community, stand together, and that's why you're so right. So for me, what we have to do from now till October 16th, it is so important to to build, to believe in one another. And what you said about, is my brother, the one that was on your street, dying. When I see people asking me for money in front of, we call it the White House, don't ask me why, where they got that idea of the refugees, it's, where they feed them there. Saint Brigitte there in front, what is it? Shepherds of the Hope. I don't know why the people, the Salvadorian call it the White House. Charity will not change the world, by the way, it's only justice. So anyway, when I see people begging for something, you know, people, we have so many ideas. Right now, my rent, I live in a house of 4 bedrooms, and all the nuns are going out. So we were paying $900, and my neighbor is French. She says, sister, call for me, please, I want to rent your house. It is going up for $1,350. She can't rent that. So there's so many things I call the rent in Toronto there, the rent control, nah, no more. So I'm learning about all what you said. Not everybody knows all this. I'm in the process of learning all that, but something is so wrong. And yet, there's something about us that is so individual. There's something about us that is so... When I was in Peru, they taught me what was to believe in a community, to stand up with my brother. And for 500 years, they were exploited, but they're still together. There's something about us, I know that we can be together. I was in Quebec City, and I know what it means to be together. Community building is probably the first thing we have to do, and I want to know what we can do about that.
Green shirt. Yeah, the green shirt. Yeah, that guy.
The first provincial election with Mike Harris in 1995, I had heard that and read that part of the reason he was elected was not so much because the majority of people had voted for him, but because a lot of people who would have voted against him had they voted didn't vote at all. And I have a confession to make. In that election, I didn't vote. And I'll never do that again. And the second time he was elected, I made a mistake by allowing someone to talk me into strategic voting. And I went ahead and I voted for the Liberals. And I shouldn't have done that. And what I've learned from that is I plan to vote my conscience in every election, not to vote against a politician, but to vote for something I believe in. And I think that that's the most intelligent political choice for me.
Got nobody else on the list? Anyone else? I've got a new, there's a new guy there, so I'm going to take him first, okay? I'll come back to you.
I just wanted to, one of the things that's really impressed me about OCAP is the way you've been able to cross cultural and linguistic and color lines. And I think you need to know how to do that. And if you have any advice, that'd be worthwhile. Okay.
All right, we'll let this man have a second shot. And I'll give priority to people who speaking for the first time.
Somebody said the government is thinking of putting disabled people into institutions. What kind of institutions do you mean? There's different kinds of institutions. There's group homes. That's the kind of institution. Or do you mean like the old institutions where they used to put mentally retarded people and they kind of lock them and forget about them, that type of thing? Oh, okay.
Anyone? I think what I'm sensing as the chair is that there's a tremendous outpouring of personal feelings and lots of things that people have to get off of their chest and to begin to organize, and that's part of what this meeting is about. I just want to remind, I guess, you know, to focus, if you can take those feelings and if you have ideas about the campaign for economic disruption and what we can do as a community to build the community, because the answers are not here. The answers are going to come, that campaign is going to come from you. Tonight is a start, the next organizing meeting is a start. And so just, you know, if you can have suggestions about that activity, that's great. You want to go? Okay. Rent strike, that's... is there that? Did you have your hand up? The woman behind you. No. Okay. Well then, Mr. Sun, there. This the first speaker.
Maybe Maybe he was making a really good point. I think to the litany of woes, we can add the broken verbal promise in 1995 to enact an Americans with Disabilities Act.
Yeah.
One of the things, and then successive promises, yada, yada, yada. It was on the April throne speech. And so they're supposed to have it in place, not just introduced, but in place by November. They've got like 100 days to do it. Anyway, one of the things the Ontarians with Disabilities Act in Ottawa did was just get a group of people together and set a date and march down to the, your local Gary Guzzo or, whoever, and always not in today. Today says Constituency Day. Can we camp out and wait for him? Can we get, you to sign that we were here and that he is going to meet with us? And those kind of camping in at the spot, maybe calling the media to, stuff like that. That seemed to be pretty effective in terms of getting them to get that back on the agenda anyways. And as a result of us doing that, I think it did have some impact in them getting the ODA way down there on number 20 out of their 21-point throne speech thing. So that was something that seemed to work well.
And it can be disruptive and fun, too.
That's absolutely essential.
Yeah. I have a comment about this phrase, anti-poverty, which I don't like. Poverty is not the problem. Poverty is a symptom of the problem, which is wealth. It is excessive wealth that causes poverty. So long as we allow people to earn and own more than they need, there will always be poverty, either in this country or the third world. Therefore, we should be anti-wealth, not anti-poverty. And unfortunately, many people in the anti-poverty movement who say they're anti-poverty, they're also for wealth. They say they're against poverty, but they believe in the continuation of the cause of that poverty. So their anti-poverty stance is a bit of a facade. And unfortunately, I fear that many people who will be involved in this economic disruption are in that category. They say they're for the poor, but they're also for the continuation of the cause of that poverty. So Mr. Clark, my question is, your group, which says it's anti-poverty, do you also envisage the state imposing limits on how much people can earn and own?
Got nobody else. Do you want to come back on it?
Yeah, I'd be happy to.
I thought you would be.
We don't usually use the term anti-poverty ourselves. We generally refer to ourselves as a poor people's organisation. And your point is well taken, that the issue is wealth. Although just tactically, we don't really so much believe in the state regulating the amount of money the wealthy can have. We just more stand for the dispossession of the wealthy by the people who need to take it from them. There's a couple of other points I wanted to respond to if I could, and one was the question of communities standing together, which I think is really central to what this must be about. And perhaps I could address it in the context of the other question that was taken up about people being hurt and some vulnerable people being hurt by a campaign of economic disruption. I don't think you can guarantee that when you mobilise against a government and you engage in a struggle that there isn't going to be some people who are caused pain. But it's possible to be very selective in how you do it, and it's possible to do it in ways that as much as possible protect vulnerable people. All kinds of examples come to my mind. In Paris, the struggles against the government just a few years ago, they organised a transport strike, but the transport workers made an exception of going out with the buses and picking up homeless people and providing them free bus service. If you talk about economic disruption, it doesn't necessarily mean you shut things down. One of the people who's going to be in Toronto throughout the economic disruption campaign comes from Mexico. And he was involved in an action in Mexico City where they targeted the transportation system and the subways there. But they didn't shut anything down. What they did on the contrary was open them up and enabled people to access the subways for nothing. So you know, there's all kinds of ways of doing things. I'd just like to finally answer the final question that was put about mobilising in immigrant communities of colour, and making those and bringing communities in. And I think it's necessary to say that under the federal Liberals, as they established the system of multiculturalism, as they like to call it, we can't ignore the fact that they promoted within immigrant communities relatively privileged gatekeepers who were left to be the so-called spokespersons for those communities, but whose real role was to function as firefighters to ensure that that the communities were not engaging in the kind of struggles they needed to, and challenging the injustices in the way they need to. And that's an ongoing problem when you're mobilizing communities. And I think that if you're going to make a difference, you've got to go into communities, work long and patiently, and make clear that you are actually offering something that's different, that you're offering an actual perspective of fighting to win. In the Somali community within Toronto, for example, we've mobilized hard to block deportations of people. We've mobilized hard to stand with that community and face, and contest the police and security guard companies that people find themselves up against. And though there have been some quite explosive struggles, we had one situation where about 200 Somali people confronted four cops who had gone into a Somali restaurant, hurt people, taken their possessions away from them. And the community mobilized very hard to confront those police, and it was a very heroic and very important episode in the struggle of the Somali community against the racism and the violence that they're subjected to. And if you're prepared to take those kinds of stands, then I think you can you can do something that's important. We had a black woman in downtown Toronto who came to us because she had been humiliated and abused by a particular security company called IntelliGuard. Our response was to get together a group of about 25 people, go out in the streets, find a couple of IntelliGuard security cops, and give them a taste of their own medicine right there on the spot. And they apologized to this woman who was with us most profusely, with dubious sincerity, but they nonetheless apologized. And the lesson was very important, because people started coming out of their houses to join us and taking up, and actually standing with us. So it does again come back to the proposition that people are not interested in just going through the motions. People really want to see a struggle that counts for something. And if you can provide that, you can start to break down the barriers and win trust.